sideboard, you know, in connection with Shamea Kiyena. Okay? It bears a certain relevance in my mind also to the business of the repetition of Shmon Esrei. Why do we repeat the Shmon Esrei? Okay? Obviously, if everybody said it, it might not be necessary. But nevertheless, this is the accepted practice that we do repeat Shmon Esrei. Why do we repeat it? Okay. Basic reason number one is so that people who are not skilled should learn from the person who is conducting the, you know, the davening, how to daven properly. This is number one. Number two, if people don't know how, at least by simply answering Amen to each of the brachas, they get the reward, you know, for the fulfillment of the davening, okay? Because this is understandable that we're talking about an ideal world, not talking about a world in which everybody is busy talking to the other person during the repetition of the Shmon Esrei. God forbid, and incidentally the Shulchan Aruch, I don't have to tell you, inveighs very, very heavily against it. It's considered you know, a lack of respect for the davening, frankly. I mean, to talk during Chazaras HaShatz, just as it is you know, to talk during the time that we read the Torah. Read the Torah, you have to listen attentively so that you can be Yotze with the Kriyas HaTorah.
I saw another reason was for the latecomers, wasn't that?
For the latecomers, there's something else. It's not specifically in connection with this. For the latecomers, they had other things that developed. As for example, pardon me?
Friday night.
Yeah, Friday night, we say, you know, Mogen Avos and so on, okay? Why do we say the Bracha and the Mogen Avos and Kachenu Mitzvasecha? What we call it's Mayein Sheva. In other words, it's a shortened version of the Shmona Esrei. So the answer given, actually, is that this was ordained for the sake of those who were coming a little late, that at least they would be able to have a share in the, you know, this sort of like a bridge version of the Friday night Shmona Esrei. Okay? There are some other things, too, that they ordained for that reason. But I don't recall that it was ever mentioned as far as the repetition of the Shmona Esrei that this is it. Basically, as I said, it was, first of all, as an exercise to teach people how to daven properly, and secondly, to enable people who didn't know how to daven how to fulfill the obligation of the recital of the prayers. These were the two basic reasons why it was done. But obviously, we defeat the purpose if we don't behave properly during the course of the service.
Not only that, it's incumbent upon the Shliach Tzibor to be able to properly daven.
Oh, thank you. That's something I didn't mention, although I had in mind. But we know, I mean, that there are some people who know how to daven properly. And unfortunately, there are other people who go up to the Omid and they daven. And I'm not sure, for example, whether to say Omein after the Bracha or not. So, if that's the case, then at least by davening silently, we have fulfilled the immediate obligation of reciting Shmona Esrei.
But for those that are supposed to answer Amen, if they don't, they have not gotten anything out of it.
You're right.
Even if the repetition is not.
You're right. Right. Absolutely right. And again, as I say, I relate it, in my mind, to Shemaya Ka'ina, even though, I mean, it's not listed as one of the cases, but nevertheless, to me, it makes sense that it falls into the same category. All right, so, a woman then is required to partake of the Kiddush. She has to hear the Bracha, and she has to answer Amen. And then I posed the question last week, and what would happen if, for example, the woman's husband is away, or let's say she happens to be an unmarried woman who's living by herself, what obligation does she have? The answer is she has the obligation to recite Kiddush for herself, because from this it's clear that she must recite Kiddush. If she doesn't have someone to say it for her, then she has the obligation to do it. Just as, even though a woman has the primary responsibility of benching Licht, but if a man, let's say, I mean, the wife is away, and it's Shabbos, so it's the man's obligation to bench Licht in his home. No question about that.
If the woman is benching, even though the wife is benching, gets some
even though she may be someplace else, but if he's home, he should have Licht in the house. No question. So, therefore, it's his obligation, you know, to bench Licht.
Okay.
Yeah, no question about that.
Okay, so this is Kiddush. All right, but now what happens here is that they add two words that are very significant, and they say it's Devar Torah, which means literally this has been ordained by the Torah. So that immediately raises the question concerning this. Says, am I? Why? Why do you say that women are obligated, you know, to recite Kiddush Hayom? Here we've laid down a principle that it's mitzvah sase shas ban gromavu, right?
Yep.
This is one of the affirmative commandments which are dependent upon time. They're called mitzvah sase shas ban gromavu, and we have learned that all mitzvahs which are dependent, that is, affirmative mitzvahs, which are dependent upon time, is losha paturos. Women are excused. So Omar Abaye, said, well, this is bidurabona. In other words, this was ordained by our sages. It's not a biblical commandment, but it's bidurabona. So immediately, Rabba Elo Omar Rabba, excuse me, I skipped the line. Viyod, let's see, Omar Abaye, all right, so Omar Rabba, right, here we are. Right.
Yeah.
So Rabba said to him, the Hod of Ator, come on. Hey, didn't we just say two lines up over here that this is ordained by the Torah? So where do you come and say that it is only Midrabbanan or Devar Torah Komar? Vio, and furthermore, he says, Kol Mitzvah Sashe Lechayven Midrabbanan. If you're going to say that women are obligated by rabbinical ordinance, right, to hear Kiddush, then why don't we require them by rabbinical ordinance to observe every mitzvah sase? Why don't we require them? I didn't say excuse them, you know, and if they want, they have the prerogative of doing it, but I'm saying, you know, require them. Say that they're just as obligated to do all these things. Midrabbanan, right, by rabbinical. So, Elo Amar Rava, so rather, Rava says, you know what this business Devar Torah is referring to. Omar Kro, the Torah says as follows. Says Zohar v'Shomer, right? In reference to Shabbos,
remember.
It's written Zohar is Yom HaShabbat HaKadosho. This is the way it's written in Parsha Yisroel. And then when we come to Parsha V'Eschanan in Sefer Devarim, so there it's written Shomer is Yom HaShabbat HaKadosho, right? Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And of course, our sages immediately, you know, were puzzled. I mean, why do we have two different words? One is Shomer, one is Zohar. And at the same time, we have the tradition that Shomer v'Zohar will recite at the same time. It's what we say in the Chodori, you know, Shomer v'Zohar v'Dibur Echot. In other words, when God said Shomer, or when he said Zohar, he said Shomer simultaneously. This is a miracle which God can do, but, you know, human beings can't say the two words simultaneously. Yeah. The Rabbeinu Shalom can do everything, okay? So obviously, why did the Rabbeinu Shalom say both Zohar and Shomer? Because he wanted to impress upon us the fact that we have two basic obligations on Shabbos. And how do we differentiate between the two? So we say, Zohar, this refers to the mitzvahs aseh that we do in reference to Shabbos, all the affirmative actions that we have for Shabbos. And the Shomer, this refers to the negative precepts that we have, not to be mechalel Shabbos by violating this, that, or the other thing. Okay, so for example, for Zohar, we have the mitzvahs of reciting Kiddush, we have the mitzvah of benching lich. These are affirmative commandments which enabled us to remember that this is the Sabbath day. When we sing Zmiras, this is like another affirmation, you know, of the principle of Zohar as Yom HaShoah Kodesh. If we sit down and we are Mavir a Sedra, as we would say, in other words, you review the Sedra. This is part of the Zohar Yom HaShoah Sakashi. In other words, everything that we do in order to enhance the spirit of Shabbos, this is Zohar. And what is Shomer? Shomer, of course, means we're not allowed to do this, not allowed to do that, not to do, allowed to, you know, to do something else, all of which have been prohibited by the law of the Torah, or through the interpretation of our sages, you know, where they extended some of these basic principles, what we call the avos melacha, in other words, literally the fathers of melacha, And they also introduced the concept of toldos malacha, in other words, offspring of if this category is prohibited, then there are other categories of prohibited labor, right, which are subsumed under a particular category. Take example. Not allowed to plow, okay? Now, if not allowed to plow, to take a comb and to pull out hair is sort of like plowing too. Why? Because you're also, taking something, which is, fertile ground, whatever it may be, and you're plucking from it or something like that. Or maybe tolesh. Tolesh means that you pluck. May not be the world's greatest example, but you understand what I mean. We have, as I say, the basic concept of ovos, and we have the basic concept of toldos. And if you go into some of the books that deal specifically with dinim concerning Shabbos, then we see, what are the 39 ovos malacha, the 39 major categories of prohibited labor, and these we say are midoraisa, and then you have, many, many others that are derived because they are similar to an av malacha. So these are some of the things. And then, of course, we have another principle, and that is a principle called shvus. Shvus means that in order to observe Shabbos, we don't do something that theoretically might be permitted, but is prohibited because we don't want to, by permitting it, encourage people to think that they can do other things which are strictly prohibited. You understand? So we have this also, shavuos, which means literally, so the word shavuos, in other words, rest up, this is Shabbos, observe Shabbos, and don't do this, because it is a category which, again, could lead to a violation of the Shabbos. All right, so Rava continues. Yep. So he says, "Kol sheyeshno b'shmira, yeshno b'tzchira." He says, "Whoever is obligated by the Torah to observe the negative commandments relative to Shabbos is also required by the Torah to observe the affirmative commandments, which are also relative to how to keep Shabbos." And the noshim, the hani noshim, women, as far as he says. Inasmuch as women are under the obligation to observe the mitzvahs leisaseh concerning Shabbos, so istuhu b'shechira, therefore they are also in the category of those who have to keep Shabbos by observing the affirmative commandments. Therefore, Kiddush falls into that particular category. So amalei ravina l'rava. So Ravina wants to pursue this a little bit further, and he asks Rava the following question. He says, "Nosha mipirkas amozin deraisa v'derabon." He says, "Tell me, when women recite the benching after the meal, okay? So, is this ordained by the Torah, or is this v'derabon?" I want to remind you again that at the top of the page, at the end of the Mishnah that we started as our text for this passage, it says over there that women are obligated, right, v'chayovim b'tfila, they are obligated to recite Shemoneh Esrei, uvim mezuzah, and they are also obligated to observe the mitzvah of mezuzah, and uvim birkas hamazon, and they are also required to observe the birkas hamazon. And we explained the other things. Why tfila? And we said because rach b'nin. In other words, in tfila, why are they required to observe Shemoneh Esrei? Because we are praying to the Rebbeinu Shalom, he shall have mercy on us, and therefore women also are obligated to pray to God. I explained for the benefit of those who weren't with us at the last session and so, that we paskin today that women are obligated to say tfila, meaning prayer, but that they are not necessarily obligated to recite Shemoneh Esrei. If a woman wants to recite Shemoneh Esrei, God bless her. But if she would simply say a few simple brachas and prayers in the morning, she has already fulfilled the obligation of tefillah, according to the Achrayim, according to the later commentators in the Shulchan Aruch. So she says Maidani, she says Shema Yisrael, she says, let's say, Anu Tilas Yadoyim, and Asher Yotzar, and things like that. So she automatically, has already fulfilled the basic obligation for her to say tefillah. But if she wants to take on upon herself the daven shachris, the daven mincha, the daven, ma'ariv, gezunta heita. Yes. Irv, did you have a
comment? No.
Okay.
Okay.
But anyway, he wants to know right now, okay, you said that birkas hamazon, they are required to. Are they required to observe it because this is midaraiso? In other words, did the Torah command it or the rabbanan? Is it only the sages who said that women should do it? So they want to know, lamai nafkamina, tell me, what is the practical difference whether a woman recites benching, whether because it is it's obligated by the Torah, or whether by the sages? So he says, lafuki rabbi midei chagosan. He says, it comes in as follows. We said a few moments ago that one person can be motzi others when it comes to benching, right? If people don't know how to bench very well, or if they want, I mean, they say, you know, the entire group decides that they want to be yotze with the benching of one person, then in that case, that person, as we said, has the zechus, shall we say, the merit, you know, of being motzi everybody with the benching, right? All right, so now the question is, says Rabbeinu, he says, Iyamit Bishlamo, the Raisa. Alright, if you say, for example, that this is a biblical commandment, right? That Birkas HaMazon was ordained by the Torah. Of course, we know what is the biblical says, right? The Yochaltim is supposed to be rough. It's that pasuk that we base it on, okay? That when you eat and be satisfied, you shall bless. So this already is commanded in the Torah, right? Alright. So if you say then that this is from the Torah, then in that case, Osi midaraisa or mafik daraisa, then in that case, someone who is under the obligation of the Torah can enable others to fulfill an obligation which is from the Torah. Therefore, what? It means, therefore, that if we say that Noshim Achayova is Bebirkas HaMazon and it's from the Torah, then in that particular case, we can say that a woman should be able to lead the benching for an entire group of people. Not talking about women, you know, for a group of women, but I'm talking about women for a mixed group, men and women, right? Since she has the obligation from the Torah, so she should also be able to fulfill the obligation of others in the Torah. Eli Yamit Bibrabonon. But on the contrary, if you say that this was only established by the sages that women have an obligation to bench, then in that case, that means that she is not obligated, you know, to bench. It's only that the rabbi said she can, but she's not obligated, right? And whoever is not required to fulfill a mitzvah, cannot cause everyone else, the multitude literally, to fulfill their obligation by doing it for them. Okay, so as you can see, this is a big problem. If we say that women have the right to do it, then what does it mean? It means then that they can do it for men, but what position does it leave a man in? I don't mean that, you know, the woman can fulfill if we accept this argument, you understand? But how would a man feel that women know how to do it and the man doesn't know how to do it?
Well, how about the other way around?
No, a woman, you know,
feel bad too.
A woman's not obligated.
But you have to remember.
Well, that's the question. Okay, is it obligated by the, if it's obligated by the Torah,
right,
then a woman can do it.
Yeah, I have to give two answers for that. Answer number one, I mean, right. I mean, if she's not obligated, then she's not obligated. Okay, then in that case, she cannot be moitzi someone who is absolutely obligated. Okay, that's answer number one. Answer number two, unfortunately, is a reflection upon education. That until now, we've raised generations of women without very much of a Jewish education. I mean, if they knew how to daven, how to make a few basic brachas and so on, that was the basic education that many women received, and it didn't go really much further than that, okay? And, of course...
That has changed.
Yeah, right. First of all, I wanted to say that, you know, that was not such a terrible catastrophe during a time when Jewish life was so intense that in every Jewish family, girls growing up had an example of what it meant to be a Jewish woman when she in turn grew up. I mean, she saw what the woman did as far as keeping Shabbos and Kashrus and, you know, to learn at least simple brachas and Krishma and things like that. Of course, many women received more of an education, I want to stress. I mean, many of them may have learned Chumash. Many women learned, for example, Dinim. Let's say they would take a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and they would learn it, okay? So many women had it, but they had the practical examples, you see, of what it was, so that in these cases, it wasn't such a terrible business, you know, because at least they were living a regular Jewish life, and they could raise future generations of Jews precisely because it was like a hands-on experience, so to say, living Jewish. But we know in our own days that this is no longer sufficient, that our women require an education the same as men do. May not mean that they have to, be, you know, break their heads over Gemara, not necessarily, but at least they have to know, you know, a lot, okay?
Well, in fact, isn't it even prohibited for a woman to learn Gemara?
Correct, according to one opinion, right. And this, of course, has been debated again and again. I mean, most of the authorities until now have defended, you know, the fact that women should not learn Gemara, because there's an expression by Rabbi Eliezer who says, "Hamalamed bitay Torah malam do tiflus," that if you teach your daughter Torah, meaning, you know, higher Torah, doesn't mean, you know, elementary Torah, then you're teaching her immorality.
Oh, really?
And this is what he said, okay? And we had it in Kedushin, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
And they brought the case about Rabbi Meir and Bruria. Bruria was extremely learned, and everybody, you know, you turned over to Pasen Chardas, and then she went off the right path, you see. So this is one of the basic reasons why they said that. But as I stress, even if a girl doesn't learn Gemara today, there is so much to learn that in all the Beis Yaakovs, no matter how frum they are, and every one of them is absolutely frum. But the girls are learning Chumash and Rashi and Novi and Shulchan Aruch. And, you know, there's no question. They're learning all these things.
Oh, yeah.
So they're training a generation, thank God, you know, which will be learning. But, of course, it makes problems, too. There's no question about that. A woman who's gone to a yeshiva, gone to a yeshiva high school, and maybe you've gone to a school like Stern or something like that, right? Sometimes, you know, she feels put out when she comes into the shul, she sits behind the batisa, and she feels that there isn't an important enough role for her to play in the synagogue. This is why we have problems.
May I ask you a question, Mr. Dr. Miller?
Yeah, what is the question?
How come the people, how come the women sit behind the curtain?
Well, that's called the mechitza.
Mechitza.
In other words, you separate physically men and women in the synagogue.
For what? What's the reason for it?
The reason being that men should concentrate on their prayers, women should concentrate on their prayers, and they shouldn't be looking at each other all the time. Mm-hmm. Or
now, this is what I ask you that, because I never knew it.
That was the way it was also in temple time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well,
so
we said, right, that in the Beis HaMikdash too, there was a special courtyard for the women,
right.
And I mentioned also about the Gemara of the Sukkah, which speaks about the special balcony that they would create for the women at that time, because the courts were just overflowing with people. But the separation of the services, they felt, was very, very important because of the sanctity, the holiness of the service. Women are holy when they live as women and men as men, and, you know, we shouldn't mix the two. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's
yeah,
good.
We can be chauvinists over here. Okay.
You say that
so,
again.
So if he wants to know, so tell me which, what is it? Is it the rice or is the rabbanon? So Toshba. So come and listen, he says, I'll quote you another quotation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from Tosefta. It says, "Be'emes amru." In truth, our sages did say, "Bein mevorech liyoviv," that a son can recite the bracha for his father, the eved mevorech l'rabo, and a slave can recite the brachas for his master, the isha mevorech l'balo, And a woman is permitted to recite the brachas for her husband. Aval obrul chachomim, but our sages said, tovol me'eva liyodom, may a curse come to any man she'ishto uvonam mevorkim bo, whose wife or whose sons have to recite the brachas for him. In other words, the man himself should have undertaken the responsibility of learning how to daven, learning how to say brachas and so on, and not have to rely upon a woman or a son in order to teach him how to do things. So, this, of course, as we see, is a very, very strong thing. And by the way, I want to point out, there's another Gemara, for example, Gemara Megillah, which speaks about, can women lay in the Torah? Can they? So the answer is, technically, they can. But it is considered in the same category of what we just said, that it is considered an insult to the men in the congregation if they're not capable of doing it and the woman is capable of doing it. So in order to avoid this kind of a situation, this is why we say that women are not allowed to have aliyahs, to go to the Torah and things like that. Okay?
A lot of Orthodox women argue for all women minyanim.
Oh, that's a very different story. Technically, than all women's minyan, they are permitted to do. I spoke about that before you came, Phil. But the truth of the matter is, you know, that there are two opinions about it. You know, those who applaud it, there are such rabbis, I mean, like Rabbi Berman in New York, you know, he's been a teacher at Stern College for many years, and then he inherited Riskin's job at the Lincoln Square Synagogue and so on, okay? He believes that women should do it, okay? And there are some others. Greenberg, you know, Irving Greenberg, another one who feels that it's okay. But on the other hand, there are many, many rabbanim who say that this is wrong. It's wrong because it is destroying the whole concept of a family coming to a shul and davening as a family.
Also because there are some things they can't do, so it ends up at best. Losing a lot. Like,
of course, absolutely. So, look, in an Orthodox shul, I mean, it's pastish. That's all there is to it.
How about the regular shul?
What do you mean the regular shul?
I'm talking about the other shuls. What do they call it?
You mean conservative temples? Reform temples.
Yeah.
They do what they have to do.
They do what they want to do, period. What they have to do, but what they want to do.
Yeah,
I mean, because they don't go. They don't go according to the law of the Torah. They don't go according to the sages. And if they'll quote something, they'll quote it only halfway, but they're quoting the rest of the sages.
So
right.
No, I do that.
It's like a smorgasbord, you know, you take whatever you want from the table and that's it. Okay. Now, the Gemara continues this, and it says, "Yamid bishlam odaraisa, osim midaraisa, umapik midaraisa." Now, if you say, again, this is repeating the same argument. If you say that women are obligated from the Torah, in other words, you know, to recite Birkas Hamazon, then in that case, let, you know, an obligation in the Torah enable her to be mitzi others. Remember what we said before. The line before, she'ishto evonim evorkin lo, right? That the wife and the children can do it. Because, after all, if they have an obligation to rise up, why shouldn't they be able to do it? V'litameich, so he continues the argument, says, and, in accordance with your reasoning, he says, koton barchi yuvohim. Tell me, he says, is a koton, is a minor child, also under an obligation? We have said before, when we were discussing this for the past couple of weeks, that the obligation of a minor child is the obligation of what we call chinuch. In other words, parent has the obligation to train a child so that when he grows up, he knows how to fulfill mitzvahs on his own. He knows how to daven, he knows how to make brachas, he knows how to shake the lulav, which is where we find the original source for this opinion. To shake a lulav and to take care of tefillin. Remember, we did that too. And Rashi explains, you know, what was the problem, you know, with tefillin, that maybe he wouldn't know how to care for it with the proper respect or things like that. Okay? So, this is what we call chinuch. You train them. This is what they have to do. But to say that they actually have an obligation while they're still minors, this is not quite so. Okay? And that's why we had this argument, for example, or if you wish, not necessarily an argument, but I spoke, for example, about the problem, let's say, of fasting on Yom Kippur. Is a minor obligated to fast on Yom Kippur? I'll say just say specifically that a minor should be taught, chinuch, to begin that, for example, he fasts 12 hours. Then he learns how to fast, let's say, a few more hours. Then he learns how to fast a few more hours after that, and so on and so forth, right?
Right.
But at what particular point is a minor obligated to actually fast the entire day of Yom Kippur? So, of course, the answer is that if she is a girl, she's obligated to do it from the time that she has passed her 12th birthday. 12 years of the day already qualifies her as an adult in Jewish life. And even though technically we learned in the Gemara Kedushin that she's a Nara for 6 months, but nevertheless, she is already an adult. She's, you know, she may not be a Bogeris, which means, you know, fully adult, but adulthood has already begun for her. And therefore, she has to begin observing things as an adult is required to observe. And the same thing with a boy, except that with a boy, the obligation begins when he reaches the age of 13 in the day. This is when he becomes a bar chiyuva. Okay? He has the obligation to observe mitzvahs just as any adult.
So they didn't tie it directly to the beginning of menstruation, for individualized for each woman then. It was just an average they picked out.
Okay, you asked a very good question. That's a very good question. They really give two simanim, okay? One of them is to tie it in to, first of all, when are hairs, when do they appear, all right? And again, the question is, are we talking about hairs in the underarm or are we talking about hairs in the pubic area, okay? So technically, if two hairs appear in the pubic area, even though a girl, for example, has not yet begun to menstruate, she is technically an adult, okay?
It's not even
and the same thing with a boy.
Right.
And the same thing with a boy, okay? But inasmuch as it is hard to say A is an adult, B is not, even though they're both exactly the same age, but one has more advanced signs of development than the other one, so that therefore, I mean, they simply had to make one general rule and say that girls become adults at the age of 12 in one day and boys at the age of 13 in one day. They simply had to do this because otherwise it would be, you know, everyone for himself, everyone for herself.
Very
it wouldn't be able to make a general rule.
It would be more a subjective thing rather than a
right, right. And then also you'd have to subject them to a physical examination, you know, I don't have to tell you. It may not always be the most pleasant
thing.
Is
that thing,
way
okay. They have a bat mitzvah at 12 then, the girls?
Yeah, technically they should. Of course, I'm not talking, you know, about... we have to distinguish between bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah in the sense of bar chiyuva, as we said, or bat chiyuva, right? In other words, under an obligation to observe mitzvahs as an adult. And, you know, the other thing that we refer to when we talk about bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, in the sense, you know, that they want to have a ceremony and a party and everything else. You understand? Ceremony and a party. No, Mela. Right. If a girl wants to have a party to celebrate her coming of age, it doesn't have to be necessarily at the age of 12 in one day. I mean, if she wants it a little later than that, because this is only the topping on the cake, okay? But the actual performance of mitzvahs as an adult begins when she reaches his 12th birthday. There's no question about that. And the same thing with a boy. What would happen if a boy got to get God forbid did not have a catered meal, for example. Or a clown, or a disc jockey, or whatever
he'd
it is, I mean, that modern bar mitzvahs have degenerated into. I mean,
he'd feel left out.
Yes.
Well, actually, when did that whole custom start? It's basically an American custom.
Well, we find that in Europe already there is some references to it in the later Middle Ages, you know, that for a boy they would celebrate his coming of age by, you know, not only giving the aliyah, this already was standard practice, okay? And the fact, of course, that he was obligated to put on tefillin, and as I told you, for the sake of chinuch, he should have began putting on tefillin even a month prior to his bar mitzvah, okay, on a regular basis, so that he would know as an adult how to do it. But we find, as I say, that in the later Middle Ages, it was already established, you know, to do these things, okay? Some boys would even get up there and give up hilful, as we would say. In other words, they wanted to show that at the age of 13, they had already learned so much Torah that they were able to give a discourse in Hebrew, you know, argue arguments, you know, they'd start with the text and then marshal arguments for it, marshal arguments against it, try to resolve the conflicts, you know, between the two different points of view, etc., etc. And this was really, you know, what a bar mitzvah boy very often did. I mean, not that he was required to do it, but he did. Okay. Now, the Shabbos bar mitzvahs, lav davka, didn't happen. Many people, you know, many boys were bar mitzvahs any day that they read the Torah, whether it was Monday or Thursday, or Shadish, whatever it may be. That's when, you know, the very first occasion after they had reached their 13th birthday, this was the time that they had the Aliyah to the Torah. And, you know, the family made a little Kiddush in order to celebrate this event, because after all, it is one of the great Jewish events in our life, okay? For my bar mitzvah, I remember we had kichel and herring, okay? And I suppose the buffalo schnapps, which I didn't participate in. But that was it. On the other hand, you know, when you start in and take a look at some of the fancy affairs that you get invited to today, and you see and what goes on, you all you see it. It certainly is a far cry from the bar mitzvah, you know, that was traditional, okay? The discourse, you know, the pilpul, whatever it may be, there are still some people who have what they call a pshetl. I don't know if you ever heard of it. Pshetl is similar, right? In other words, you
small
say
shot.
Words, right, whatever it may be, in order to show, you know, how learned you are and so on. The problem with pshetls is that very often it's no longer the original work of the boy himself, but instead, whose work is it?
Rabbi.
His Rebbe, right, the Rebbe writes it, so he's really displaying a tremendous amount of erudition, but it's not his own erudition, it's his Rebbe's erudition, you see. But that has also become a custom. From this it developed into the traditional fountain pen speech.
Yeah, I heard that speech before.
Okay. Which fortunately we rarely see today, but nevertheless there are still some shuls and there's still some rabbis who like that the bar mitzvah boy should deliver a fountain pen speech, you know. I thank you for this, I thank you for that, and I promise to be a good boy, and I promise to do this, that, and the other thing. And well, what can I say? I know that when I was bar mitzvah, I refused to give a bar mitzvah to Hashem. I refused. I said I'm not going to tie myself down hypocritically to something that I may never realize in my life. But it didn't faze others from getting up there and say, dear parents, relatives, and friends, etc., etc., you know, the rest of the jazz over there. And then the next day, you never saw them again on the show.
That's true.
Oh, well. Okay. All right. So, the question is, will itame koton barchi yubahu? So tell me, is a minor then required, you know, to observe mitzvahs? And as we said, this would mean, you know, a biblical requirement to observe mitzvahs, or is it only mit the Rabbonin that he observes what he observes? You understand? So, Elohochi b'mayaskin, so what are we dealing with over here, where it says that Bein Mevorech Leov, right, that a son can recite the bracha, in other words, specifically the Birkas Hamazon for his father. We're not dealing with a case, he says, where the father is too ignorant to know how to do it, although unfortunately in America we have kids who are better educated than their parents today. So in this case I don't think that it would be outlandish if they would do it, but it would be wonderful if the parents would catch fire and begin you know, to learn how to behave as Jewish parents.
It also refers to perhaps the father is too sick or can't do it, he has a,
okay, fine,
a stroke or
there's
something,
no question,
you know, it's possible.
No question.
There are all sorts of extenuating
circumstances. You're 100% right. There are cases where there's no question that this is the right thing to do, and where we could justify it even you know, by saying that the Nidoraisa, I mean, he should be doing these things. Okay. But they give a different example over here. He says, "Elo hochi b'mayiskin." So, what kind of a case are we dealing with over here? He says, "Kegoyin she'ochal shiura derabbanon, deyosi derabbanon u'mafik derabbanon." He says, like for example, the father didn't touch anything except maybe just a crumb of bread or something like that. Okay. Didn't eat enough to require technically birkas
hamazon. He didn't need a kazayas, right.
So, in this particular case, the son did eat a kazayas, or according to others, a kibetza, because there are differences of opinion as to what constitutes the minimum requirement of food for which to bench. Okay? So, therefore, inasmuch as who indicated the shiurim? The Torah, if you remember, has one general statement. It says, V'yachalto v'sovata, right? Uveirach. Which means you are to eat, you are to feel satisfied, and you are to recite the Birkas HaMazon. But how do we know what kind of a shiur represents the v'sovata? How much do you have to eat in order to be satisfied? I mean, we know, first of all, this is going to vary with the individual. What I need to satisfy me may not be, what it takes for you to be satisfied. Certainly I know, my wife and I, we have two different shiurim for this. So, under these circumstances, the rabbis therefore came and they gave a minimum requirement. As I said, namely that if you eat a kazayas according to one authority, or a kibetza according to another one, this is what is required as a minimum amount of food for venture.
Neither of them would satisfy me. An olive or an egg.
Okay, then in that particular case, I mean, if you didn't really make hamotzi, you don't have to bench, you know. What you do, you say other brachas, you know, there are brachas that we say after food, but they're not required, okay? But here he's really talking about where the father did eat but not enough. The son, on the other hand, ate plenty in order to fulfill. So, in order to make sure that at least the shiur is being observed, therefore the son has the right to lead the benching for his father so that the father could be yotzei also as if he had eaten the minimum requirement. Alright, we'll go up to the Mishnah. Dorash Rav Avira. Rav Avira gave the following drasha. Because Dorash means, you know, that he interpreted a verse in the Torah, and, he used it in order to teach us a very important lesson, an important teaching. Zimnin Omalav Ishmeda Rav Ami. At times he said that he got this idea from Rav Ami. The Zimnin, and at times, Omalav Ishmeda Rav Asi. He said, no, he got it from Rav Asi. All right, in any case, what's the difference whether he got it from Rav Ami or Rav Asi? But of course, you have to realize, we have a statement in Pirkei Avos that says, if somebody says something in the name of the person who has said it, so maybe Gula Leonim, then he can bring redemption to the world. And how do they know that? They bring this example from the Megillah Esther. It's written over there about Esther la Melech b'shem Mordechai, that Esther mentioned, you know, told what had happened. This happened to be the conspiracy of Bigthan and Zeresh, and she told about it to King Ahasuerus in the name of Mordechai. The fact that she mentioned that she had gotten this from Mordechai eventually brought about the Geula, because if you remember later on in the Geula we read that at night he couldn't sleep, and he said, you know, read to me from my book of Chronicles, and they read, and suddenly he discovered that Mordechai had saved his life, and he wanted to know, has anything ever been done for Mordechai? And this brought about the eventual redemption of the people from the hands of, the anti-Semitic Haman. So, this is why it's important for us to give credit where credit is due. If we have learned something from someone, we should mention the source from which we have learned this lesson. Right. So, at any rate, Omru Malochi Asher Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the heavenly angel said to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One Blessed He, they said to him, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, Torah says, Hashem lo yisa ponim li'kach shochet. It says about Rebbeinu Shel Olam that he does not show favoritism, nor does he take any bribery. The Bnei Shel Olam is absolutely impartial, right? And of course, naturally, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to follow the Bnei Shel Olam's midos also. Okay. Now, but the angels complain, they say, hey, you are showing favoritism to the people of Israel. Dichsiv, and as it is written, Yiso Hashem Pono Velecho, right? May God literally lift up his countenance unto you. So this is also Nisiyas Ponim. In other words, the Bnei Shel Olam is showing favoritism to the people by giving them this bracha of the Pirkas, the Pirkas Kohanim. Okay? So Omar Lahem, so you know what the Bnei Shel Olam answered the angels? He said, Dechi lo yeso ponim liYisrael. Tell me, shouldn't I take a show favoritism to the people of Israel? Shekosavti lohem b'Torah. I wrote for them in the Torah, V'yachalta v'savota v'yachlis Hashem alekecho, that when you eat and you are satisfied, in other words, you had plenty to eat, then you bench the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. V'heim edaktikim alatzmo mat kizayis v'yad kitbeitza. And they are strict with themselves that they bench, even if they've only eaten the size of a kizayis or the size of an egg, which, as I said, you know, there's rabbinical dispute about it, but the point is, it certainly doesn't go to the area of being absolutely zot that they can't eat anything else. Okay?
Alright,
so Yirtzeh Hashem, next week we shall continue at the same time at 7 o'clock, and we'll be davening Mincha also next week, also at 8 o'clock as well. Okay, we'll recite Kaddish Rabban, and then I have to go to a Shiva Minyan right now.
I would say that you'd have to, under those circumstances, be a little bit more selective as to the material. You see, we can take and start from page base and go right through until we make a siyum in Yirtzeh Hashem. But, for someone who is working with a mixed group, it probably would make better sense to be selective in the material and decide what to do. Right. Phil was reminding me about the statement made by a man who's living in West Hartford right now.
And his son is an Orthodox rabbi who's, he's a chaplain in an army camp, and he's teaching Gemara, non-Jewish.
Wants to sit in.
Yeah.
He's trying to think of his first name, Hal.
It's unusual for them to teach it in the army camp.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's better than to sit down and to play cards all the time.
I think
it's
sick
back
there.
It's more merit to it. Okay, so I want to just finish up what we were doing last time with one more Tosfos, okay? And the Tosfos is the third one on the page where he says, Noshim b'pirkas ha-mozen de'raisa d'rabbanan. Okay. The Mishnah on the top of the page, if you remember, after speaking about things that women are excused from because of this mitzvah sasa she'esman gromo, so then it says, v'chayovim, because why is it masculine plural? Because they were also talking about avodim and katadim. And, each of them are really, all right, but Avodim, that's not very applicable today. But the question is Ketanim. And this, as we saw, there's a whole discussion in Tosfos as to what exactly do we mean by Ketanim, to what age, because we have a contrary mitzvah, and that is the mitzvah of Chinuch, which says that you've got to teach a child, you've got to teach your son, certainly, to observe, so that as soon as he's old enough, for example, to be able to shake a lulav, so you give him a lulav and and you teach him how to make a brach and everything else. As soon as he's independent enough to be able to sit in the sukkah without soiling himself or something like that, right? So you take him into the sukkah and so on and so forth. And at an early age as possible, you expose him to the blowing the shofar, to reading the Megillah, and lighting Chanukah lift and everything else, you see. So Ketanim really fit into a different category, as we said, and why it's all lumped together, this is already this is a different problem, right? But the conclusion is that there are certain things that they are obligated. One of them is tefillah, which would mean she's going to Esther. In other words, a woman should recite Shemoneh Esther 3 times a day. But as I told you, Today, the opinion is a little bit more lenient because they realize, that in spite of the fact that women should, but not every woman really has the opportunity to do it.
So if you say three times a day, aren't you bringing in the matter of time?
Of course you are.
Because you say about filling. Now, filling
right.
You can say filling all day.
Yeah,
that seems less than time. Than like,
Actually, it happens to be a very good point because of the fact, if you take a look at the Tosfos right on the top where he quotes Rashi, it says, with Philip Shita, it says, Kevin Dixiv, Erev Avoke, Vitzorayim, Osicha Ve'emeh, right? David HaMelech wrote in Tillim that evening, morning, and noon, will I meditate and I will speak about your commandments, so therefore it's Kemitzvah Sasa Shezban Groba, right? So there's no question that it's sort of like Mitzvah Sasa Shezban Groba. So from that point of view, right. But you see, what they said was that why do we take it out of the category of Mitzvah Sasa Shezban Groba in the case of the women or children and so on? But the answer is because it is Rachman. In other words, we are begging the Rabbeinu Shalom to have mercy upon us. It's a personal request. So for the personal request, there's no objection, to a woman reciting it. But as I said, the Achronim realize that there are so many other demands upon a woman's time these days. She doesn't necessarily have the time to sit down and to say Shemanesra or to daven or things like that. And so therefore, by tefillah, they are content if she says some brachas in the morning, say krishma and things like that, so she's yotzei already for the whole day. Herb?
No, I was going to say, is it an obligation, or are they permitted to do it? They're permitted to do it, but is it an obligation?
No, according to the Mishnah, it's an obligation, right. So what has happened is that the Achronim decided that while the obligation may exist, but if circumstances are such that she can't do it, so that therefore they excuse her, but she should say at least something. So that a day doesn't go by without at least thanking the Rabbeinu Shalom.
But she's permitted to do a lot more than what.
Correct. This I quoted again and again that there's a very famous Tosfos which says that if a woman takes upon herself that she wants to observe a mitzvah asish as man groma, such as for example the Ben Shulam, and so on, the Masukah, listen to the shofar. Right? That's already a different problem.
A lot of women do it.
Yeah, I know. But the point is that the Tosfos permits a woman to recite a bracha even. She's saying, Asher v'nishon v'tosav v'tzivonu. And even though women were not exactly commanded to do these things, yet Tosfos says that it's absolutely proper. A woman takes upon herself the obligation to recite this bracha, and it's not a bracha levatola, which is a concern that we always have concerning the bracha. So that in practice, we're much more lenient than what the Mishnah itself would indicate. We have to realize, too, that while the Mishnah very often is the basis of the law, as we find it in Shulchan Aruch, but still, there have been many, many codes of law that follow the Mishnah, such as the Yad Chazaka of the Rambam, and such words as the Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, the Tur, the Shulchan Aruch, and of course in our own day, for example, the Mishnah Brura, which is based upon the Shulchan Aruch Aruch Chaim, but the Chofetz Chaim, when the Levracha, added his own personal commentary as well to the Aruch Chaim of it. He doesn't have it on any of the other, it's only on the Aruch Chaim, which is that part of the Shulchan Aruch which deals with daily brachas, daily prayers, and Shabbos and Yontif and so on. This is what it deals with, but it doesn't go into the question of kashrus and things like that, because that already is in the Yoredeya. Okay?
So the halacha as decided sometimes in the Mishnah and Gemara is not necessarily the halacha.
Correct. And sometimes they'll even say that the hilkason, the halacha is this and this, and yet, as time went on, it was not the halacha. In other words, they didn't accept it. There are cases in the Gemara mentioned, for example, that this great authority said that this is the halacha, right? Nevertheless, they did not accept it.
Doesn't that create problems, though? Since
sure it does.
Since this was given at Sinai, if the oral Torah was also given at Sinai,
right.
Whenever, therefore, in my own mind, it's been a problem. In the Gemara, if it says that a baby 8 months is born in 8 months can't survive, and I say, well, medically, this is absolutely not correct.
Correct.
And then if we say the oral Torah was given at Sinai, and it has to be correct, unless there was a mistake in the transition from generation to generation orally, then create certain problems.
Oh, well, Phil, I mean, you're raising a very, very valid point. I just have to say that in that respect, that in general, we would say, that the mitzvahs and their general interpretations were given. But the Talmidei Chachamim in every generation were given the authority to interpret the Torah and to derive from it the things, that are necessary for their generation, and the Talmud even has a very very startling statement to the effect that, for example, Yiftach b'dorei k'Shmuel b'dorei, which means that Jephthah and his generation have the same kind of authority that Shmuel had in his own generation. Now, how are you going to compare Shmuel and Yiftach? I mean, they're two different types of characters altogether, and there's no question in anybody's mind that if you would compare the ability to know Torah and the Nevi'ahs and everything else, Shmuel was definitely the superior to Yiftach. But still, Yiftach had to be the leader in his own generation. And so this is true also in our own generation, except that, thank God, we have many, many Talmidei Chachamim in our own generation. Thank God they're not all Yiftachs. But still, it is a very, very important problem. And there's a Gemara that says that Kol ma she'Talmid Chacham osid l'chadesh, whatever a Talmud Chacham is going to come up with a chiddush, in other words, some new understanding, new interpretation, says it's called Nemar b'Sinai. It was already said at Mount Sinai. So the meaning has to be that implicit in the revelation of Mount Sinai was the fact that it would require all these interpretations. But to specifically say that this particular din is necessarily at Sinai when there are other authorities who dispute the meaning of it, it would be a little bit far-fetched, in my opinion.
Well, the Torah of Shabbat was given at Mount Sinai, okay?
Correct.
But the commentary, the Gemara commentary, was not given at Sinai.
No,
that was made later on. So the interpretation was left to the later generations.
No.
So if they expressed it as if the law, you can stand on it, but I don't think you can change it. There's nothing you can change.
Right.
They're not allowed to change.
Yeah, well, we have problems in that respect, too.
I thought that the Gemara, in fact, was the Torah Shabbat, and that
it is the Torah Shabbat,
and the Gemara
was the
knowledge was
correct, but so are the codes
transmitted from generation to generation.
Right, but then, as I say, the codes are also Torah Shabbat, the Shilas and Tshuvas are also Torah Shabbat, if you wish. I mean,
theoretically.
Right. I mean, all of these things.
But
and God knows how many thousands and thousands of Shabbos and Shulas have been written during the course of the generations, including in our own day. Tremendous library of them.
But in actuality, when they say that Torah was handed down from Sinai, Moses to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, etc., and so on to the great assembly, doesn't that refer to the Mishnah as we know it today?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, that they're referring to the oral interpretation.
Oral
there's no question.
Not only the Mishnah.
The Mishnah was the first codification, so to speak, of the oral Torah. But after all, the Midrashim also came in. Now, many Midrashim are Midrashi Halacha, where, they interpret the various laws of the Torah, from a halachic point of view. And, of course, the Gemara will quote extensively from these Midrashim. But on the other hand, you also have Midrashei Agada. And when it comes to Agada, that's already a different story. It's not halacha. And in Agada, we say, at least the Rambam felt that you were not under any obligation to accept each and every single statement that we find in the Agada. There are beautiful things, wonderful things, and so on, but occasionally there's something over there which sort of jars us, you see. Okay? So that it does not have the same authority,
same weight,
right, the same weight, if you wish, I mean, that the halacha has. But again, I repeat, implicitly in the revelation of Mount Sinai were, you know, the halachas that we practice today, but they're absolutely subject to interpretation, to understanding, to development. But the problem, you know, comes in that when people deliberately do not believe in halacha l'moshe m'Sinai and things like that and so on, and then they set up their own halacha simply on the basis of their own imagination, you see. This is where the problem comes in, right?
Well, or yeah. When the people who don't believe will specifically pick out things from the Mishnah Gemara which are, by our present day science, incorrect. Like
yeah.
8 months, they said that they
right,
survived
right.
on the 7th and 9th.
Yeah.
They say, well, how did that happen?
Yeah, well, that in itself is not a halacha, that a baby 8 months old.
Well, maybe that was their experience at that time.
Besides, you could always say that the woman miscalculated. All right, so
nope.
Let me just review this. All right, anyway, we said that a woman is obligated to recite Birkas HaMazon. Why? So in the Gemara we saw, because they say that Birkas HaMazon is Bidoraisa, okay? Torah says, so therefore we say that this is a mitzvah Bidoraisa. All right, so this is the point that Pesach is questioning right now. Okay. Says Noshim Bivirkas HaMazon D'Oraisa or the Rabbanan. Question is, are women obligated to bench because it is a mitzvah that the Torah D'Oraisa. Tells them that they have to bench, or is it because of the rabbis? Now, of course, you understand. I mean, if we say it's only with the Rabbanan, then it means that if the rabbis say, you know, that she should bench, then it means that maybe there are circumstances under which you shouldn't. Or maybe there's a different reason why, even though it's not Midaraisa, but maybe women bench in general, in spite of the fact that from the Torah they're not commanded to. In other words, maybe the mitzvah Midaraisa is only for the men and not for the women. This is what Tosfos wants to discuss now. Perish HaKutras always means, you know, that he says, okay, Rashi interprets as follows. The Salkadate Filimachai Midaraisa, you might think that they are not obligated to bench from the Torah itself, the wording of the Torah. Why? Mishum Dirsiv, because what does it say in that pasuk? It's written Al Horat Satova, right? The good land. And he says, Venoshim Lainotu Chelik Boretz, the women did not have a share in the real estate. In Eretz Israel, when
land.
You know, when they settled over there. Now we come back to the thing that we've been talking about the past few weeks, all right? And how about the daughters of Tzolofchod?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
they took. So what did they have? So they had Telekavihim. They took the share that would have been given to their father. Okay. But the understanding was that if instead, you know, their father were alive, or there were sons and not, I mean, even they themselves made the point, you know, that Uldain ain't low, you know, that he has no son. So in that particular case, this is what they were. But as a normal rule, we say that women did not have a share in the land. Of course, I have to tell you that subsequently, once the settlement had taken place, the people of Israel were settled in Eretz Israel, then women could own real estate in Eretz Israel like men. You know, if a father, for example, gave, you know, in his will, he gave to his daughter because he had no sons, absolutely legitimate according to the law of the Torah. Okay? All right, so she got married or something like that. So automatically, then it would be like a joint ownership. Okay? But again, you know, the Gemara goes into all kinds of complicated business of what we call Nirsei Magug and Nirsei Tzoyne Varzel. In other words, certain things remain inalienably her property in marriage, and other things become the property of a husband in marriage. And therefore, you know, if she should pass on, then the husband has the right to dispose of it, whereas with the other type, she is the only one who could really decide what to do with the property that she has.
Well, weren't they also concerned about the fact that she might marry into some other tribe?
Yeah, that was the point that was raised last week. They said exactly the last thing, you know, that they said, you know, that the girls marry outside of the tribe, then land which should have gone to our tribe will go instead to a different tribe. So the decision was made that as far as this particular Dor HaMidbar, or the Dor HaKibush, if you wish, the generation that took part in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, and that took part in the division of the land, so they were subject to the fact that women should not marry outside of their tribe.
Right.
Okay. But subsequently, they lifted that ban, particularly as the famous case.
Once they settled.
Yeah, right. And incidentally, you know that we have a holiday called Tu B'Av, or Tisha B'Av. I didn't mean Tishbev, I mean Chabishosabov, excuse me. Pardon me. The other one is Tesbev. This is Tubev, by the way, the 15th day of Av, okay? And one of the things that Gemara and Tainus says why we celebrate it is because this was the day upon which the ban was lifted against women marrying outside of their tribe, that they could marry whoever they wanted from whatever tribe that they wanted. So this is one of the things that they celebrated on this particular day.
Mm-hmm.
All right, getting back over here. All right, so far the argument is as follows. How can we say that women are obligated midoraisa for benching when it's written al oretz hatoiva, and women did not have a share in the oretz, right? All right. So the Timo. So now Tosfos says, hey, but this is surprising, I mean, that Rashi should make such a comment, because there are others also who didn't have a share in the land. Who didn't have a share in the land? Kahanim and Leviim.
That's right.
Okay.
They
also. Nami Tavoy, why don't you ask about them? Sha'arei Lenot L'Chelek Boretz. After all, they didn't have a share in the land either. So in that case, we would say that if a Kain or a Levi would bench for the Elam, since he's not allowed to own a share of the land of Eretz Yisrael, so he wouldn't be able, midoraisa, to enable others to fulfill the mitzvah of benching. We spoke about, you know, the fact that one person could bench for a group,
mm-hmm.
and if everybody answers amen and so on, you know, and has, as we would say, the kavona, you know, that they have the intention to be yotzi with that person's benching, then they are yotzi with it. Okay, so we would say, okay, no, maybe then can't do it either. So Eliyeshlema. So therefore, says Tosfos, let me suggest the following. Okay, the Talmud mishum d'tziva bris kosher santa v'sareinu yadrosos shelim adetonim. The reason why we would say that women are not obligated midoraisa is because of the other two things. It's written in the, remember, you know, in Leidel Lechot, it's written al bris kosher santa v'sareinu. In other words, your covenant, which you have sealed in our flesh. Obviously, the women lack that essential part of the anatomy in which we can have the bris. Okay?
Yes,
all right. The Alte Rosko Shalim, this is why I didn't want a woman here tonight. The Alte Rosko Shalim Atonu. And also for the Torah, which you have taught us. And as Tosfos says, you know, the Noshim Lesnihu, Leibe Bris, but Leibe Torah. And women are not obligated either as far as the bris is concerned, nor as far as Torah is concerned. The Aminul and Kamen. Furthermore, it says further on in the Gemara in Brachas, later on in one of the latter chapters, Mishali Omar Bris Vater Vadir Kasa Mose Mayotzi Dechavose. That if you have not mentioned, thanks to God, the Noda Lepor, for the covenant and also for the gift of the Torah and the benching, then you have not fulfilled your obligation in benching. Those are two elements that must be mentioned as part of the benching. So the hashto coming by lay, so now we have the following question. Cave then lay much bris v'seira, since women could technically not say bris v'teira, right? So lo yhavu element rabbanan, then we have to say that when they bench and they say these things, this is only because the rabbanan said that they do it, but it's not the deraisa. Oh, Dilman, or now Tosfos comes with another. Maybe.
Dilman
means perhaps, right? Okay. Or perhaps he says, "Kevin l'shayach behu," since it doesn't apply to them, heavy shabbi with the raisa. So maybe taka from according to the law of the Torah, they are required. I mean, the Torah would require only; it would require everybody, but for men there's an extra requirement, and for women there isn't an extra requirement. Okay, the hodul come and myre ban noshim, the shayach the bris b'sala. And the only thing is that later on, you know, they say that it applies to the men where it is applicable to talk about bris and Torah. But as we can see, the idea being then what? That if women really have the obligation of the raisa, So we're questioning, is there or not? And the Tosfos offers at least one solution by saying that, okay, so they don't have the anatomy for it, or they don't have the mitzvah, you know, to study Torah. But still, they're not, you know, their obligation is still there, midaraisa, because the Torah commands them to do what they can. Okay? But if you wish, as we say, then the bris and Torah specifically refers to men, and in that case, maybe it is midarabanan. All right, I mean, we don't have to worry about whether it's midarabanan or midaraisa. So the fact is that women bench and they say these things. Yes?
Was it last week, though? We said that if a man cannot say it, a woman or a minor son is allowed
to
bench,
right, absolutely.
Or to do other things for the man.
Right,
so that must mean that she's obligated if she can fulfill the obligation.
You're absolutely right, which goes to show it's very good. Very good. which goes to show us that, in general, the only thing we can say in reference to that is, first of all, if it's midaraisa, then as we said, the shapir, then in that case, fine. I mean, there's no question. Nobody's even going to raise a question about it. But if we do raise a question, then if women are doing it, they're doing it under circumstances where the rabbis themselves permit it to happen. But it also said, Tova Me'era, let a curse come upon a man who doesn't have the education in order to do these things. A man should have the education to be able so that he's not dependent upon his wife to be Mosi.
Right. Or his child. Right, exactly. Okay. Then, of course, they came up with another thing, and we have reference to the child, you know, that maybe the father didn't eat enough of a kezias, and the child maybe did eat a kezias, so that it would be more fitting for the child to be Mosi the father in this case, simply because he had a shiur deraisa, as we would say, and the other one didn't. What the shiur deraisa is, so that we remember last week we said, according to one authority, it's kezias, and the other one it's kevetza. In other words, you know, the size of an egg. Of course, what they are in terms of our own, that already we need modern commentaries which tell us how many grams are in this, and so on and so on.
How big?
Yeah. I've never yet figured out, I'll be honest with you, how, when it comes to the Pesach Seder, for example, they decided that one piece of regular matzah is the equivalent of a kezias.
You have to try crumbling it up.
There are some matzahs that are bigger than others. For instance, the shmur matzah is much bigger than the square. We're not talking about a shmur matzah. We're talking about a machine matzah. Now, of course, again, I don't know. Do they mean like the Rakuzan matzah, which is smaller? Or do they mean, you know, a Horace White Red matzah?
Really quite a bit of matzah.
They might have taken the raw dough before they make it.
Well, they say actually that it's supposed to be based upon taking the matzah and crumbling it and see what the quantity is. Yeah. Well, listen, there are people, as I say, who devoted their lives to trying to figure out the shiurim, and if it has come down to us that this is a shiur for matzah, unless, God forbid, a person isn't well enough to eat that much, so in that case you're obligated to eat it. If you can't, you ask a shaliach. You know. Same thing with wine, for example. It's supposed to have a rabbis wine, particularly for the first cup and so on, okay? Now, for some people, this wine is too much. All right, so first of all, they came up with grape juice as a substitute for wine,
particularly
okay?
You're supposed to have a cup that's a certain amount.
Yeah, well, that's what I say. It has to hold, you know, roughly about this much. Yeah, three and a half, four. Again, people differ as to what they mean by the rabbis. Some say it's 4 ounces, not three or three and a half.
If you put 12 ounces of wine, you can get loaded.
I'm the only one who drinks all the wine.
I use wine only, but nobody else in my family can do it. I'm simply not up to it. Although my granddaughters seem to be doing a better job at it, particularly one of them than her parents.
Well, it's better to drink less wine than to drink grape juice.
Right.
Well, actually, you don't have to drink the full kites anyway.
All right. Of course, there are two other factors. You're right. You have to drink the rov kos. You have to drink at least most of the cup.
Yeah, like 2/3.
Okay. That's one thing. The other one is the fact that if the wine is too strong, you are permitted to add some water to it to dilute a little bit. That could also be done. And in fact, in ancient days, the wine was so strong that it had to be diluted before you could make a bracha over it. This is what we'll learn later on with God's help.
That's what my Iranian son-in-law always does. When he drinks wine, he puts in a drop of water. It's a tradition that they never will drink.
Yeah,
it's
well, the Gemara, of course, actually has it. You know, the Mishnah says,
They use the expression, for example, mozgulokos. Now, what is mozgul? Mozgul means that they mix it. Now, obviously, what did they mix? It means that they mixed wine with water. So that in ancient days, this was the rule. I mean, because the wine was so strong that it could put you under the table. And that's why they ask the question, for example, can you make a bracha bori pri hagafen over wine which is not diluted with water? One opinion is, no, that you don't do it, you should say shahakol, because it's like grape juice. On the other hand, today we pass with that grape juice, you say bori pri hagafen. So, as you can see, the halacha varies in this way itself.
Yeah. One part grape juice will shahakol?
Yeah. There was an opinion, but now we say Bori Piyagun for it. Authorities will differ, I mean, we realize. But the question is, again, I mean, even if authorities differ, what is the basic practice is what we have to be aware of. All right. The new Mishnah. Balkeri Mahare Belibo Vienna Mavore Loilifunecha Veloyakrecha. Okay. A man who has a seminal emission, which could be either as a result of intercourse, or some, you know, that he has a seminal emission even without intercourse, okay? So it says that in reference to Kriya Shema, he shouldn't utter the words, but simply Maharher Belibo. He just thinks the words mentally, you know, that's it, okay?
Have it in his heart.
Yeah. The Einam of Ore, nor does he recite the bracha before the Shema, or the Fanecho, or the Ilach Reho, nor the bracha which follows the Kriya Shema. Okay. Needless to say, this is going to require more discussion, so let's finish the Mishnah first and start on the Gemara, and then we'll discuss it further. Okay? The Alhab Nozoin, and how about benching? So it says, he does bench aloud. This time he says it. This is the understanding. Right?
Uh-huh.
He says it, yeah. La'acharov, meaning after. This is what we call, you know, the Birkat HaMazon, which, you know, as in the Soilom, etc., etc. Right? The Yeinu Mevarech Lefonov. But he does not recite the Bracha HaMotzi before it. He doesn't say that. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer. But Rabbi Yehuda says, he says that you have to recite the bracha before and after. Okay? So we see already that Rabbi Yehuda, first of all, is disagreeing with, as we would say, the Stam Mishnah, which means the anonymous author of this particular Mishnah. And at the same time, if you'll notice over here, that little test, as I pointed out to you, indicates that when it comes to the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Rambam, etc., etc., that the din is that he does recite it. Why does he recite it? Because here we have to go into understanding historically what is this Mishnah referring to. So let's take a look at the Rashi. All right, says Balkeri, says Nitakonas Ezra Ve'eles, says this was a special takona, a special enactment that was ordained by Ezra, and from Ezra's time on, Shetikein Dilo Levale Kriyin. He said that if a person had a seminal emission, then before he could begin to resume the study of Torah, or of course in this case then to recite Krishna, which after all is also connected with the idea of Torah, right? That he had to have Vila. In other words, he had to immerse himself in a mikvah.
That isn't the present rule.
No.
<I hope not>.
By no means. Okay. I can see another difficulty. Usually, when you go in the mikveh, you know, you don't immediately become, you know, fit already to do. I mean, you usually have to wait until the evening before you can be 100% okay. This is what we call Harev Shemesh. Now, of course, in certain cases, the Torah says specifically, I mean, that this is the case. But this can be interpreted, you know, in a more general way, that even though you're table by day, but you're not really yotzei until the evening. But this doesn't apply anyway to us. It doesn't apply to us. But this was a special takana, a special edict, if you wish, right, that Ezra HaSofer ordained, and the question is, why did he? So this is discussed the Kedam Nim and Baba Kama Perek Meruba, that over there he felt that he wanted the men not to be so involved with their women that you know, they would be bottled from Divrei Torah. So the expression that's used over there is to the effect, you know, like a rooster with a hen, you see. The rooster is always chasing the hen around. So that the man, you know, would be so occupied with his desire, you know, for his wife and so on, that he won't study Torah. And so therefore he said, okay, you want to have relations with your wife? Guns good. But you have to be in a state of purity to study Torah. So that this was the basis of the Takana of Ezra. But of course, needless to say, we do not follow that today. It hasn't been followed probably for 2,000 years either, you see. Because they discovered, obviously, that people wouldn't get any studying done, you see. So under these circumstances, this particular edict became a dead letter.
Well, it's only a miss on Friday night, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything else is extracurricular.
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting. There are references of Gemara as to the frequency. Some people,
oh, really?
Yeah, are commanded to have a greater frequency of relations than others.
Depending on your occupation.
Yeah, depending on your occupation, exactly.
Oh, really?
Okay, right. In other words, let's say if you were a sailor. A sailor only does it once in a while, because after all, he's out sailing all the time.
Yeah.
See? Okay, so he has only an obligation whenever he comes back to port or something like that. Okay. People who are camel, not just
driver.
Camel herders, but, you know, people who have to, like we have balagolas, you know, they had, you know, people who would, so they used to use camels, let's say, for caravans, or donkeys for transportation and things like that. So if this person hired out his services, you know, and the service of his animal, so naturally it was a hard occupation, and we assume, you know, that he doesn't have the same frequency and so on. A Talmud Chochem, he's the one who's expected to do it every Friday night.
Every
okay?
Friday night. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, that depends upon how cooperative the wife is.
Is the obligation different from whether you've already had children or not had children? Or you had a
That's already a
already?
Different problem, correct. I mean, the question is also whether you have fulfilled the mitzvah period of Erivia, okay? That is a factor, no question about that. And the question is, again, what is the mitzvah period of Erivia? There are differences of opinion. Beis Hillel said that if you have one son and one daughter, then you have fulfilled the obligation.
Thank God.
Yeah. Beis Shammai says, on the other hand, that you have to have two sons and two daughters.
Okay.
But you know, who do we paskin according to? The Beis Hillel. All right, so we'll accept that. But on the other hand, that's only a minimum. I mean, on the other hand, if you decide that, you know, God's blessings, you can have 7, 8, 10 children, you so obey, you know, I don't have
right.
to tell you. There's still a big battle raging, you know, as to whether, from the point of view of halacha, contraception is permitted or contraception is not permitted. And even Gemara gave a couple of examples where contraception would be permitted. In the case of a minor girl, or in the case of a woman who was still nursing or something like that. So they gave a woman permission to use contraception.
But not a man.
Not a man, right. A woman, yes, and a man, not. Yeah. So they recognize the idea, but of course I don't have to tell you that from the strict point of view of halacha, period of Arabia has no limits, you know, okay? But obviously if you have fulfilled, then you don't have the same responsibility, the same onus, shall we say, as if you know, you had not as yet fulfilled the obligation. All right. So let's continue with the Rashi first, then we'll go on to the Gemara. All right, Mahar here. So he says, Mahar Krishma Balibo. In other words, he simply thinks mentally about the words of Krishma in his mind, in his heart, literally. Kishamaki Asbanav Mikram, when the time comes to recite Krishma. The Yeinu Mevorech, and he recites the blessing, and Rashi adds, Afilu Behiru. He doesn't even think the bracha, the words of the bracha. And then it says, Now, why shouldn't he do it either before or after the Krishna? So the answer is, Kevin de Brochus lab in the Raisa, inasmuch as to recite blessings, this is not ordained by the Torah, but instead it was ordained by our sages, this is the Rabbanon, right? So therefore, lo isrichu harabbanon, so the sages can come along and say that they don't require him to recite it, okay? So not even mental. On the other hand, the alamozim evorech liachrov, why? The chiyuv adoraisahu. Torah itself commands us, v'yachal v'savotan, so since it says that, so therefore he does recite this. It's not just think it, but recite it, okay? But not make the bracha before the lav deraisahu, because again the bracha that we say hamotzi, or any of the other brachas like Bori Pri Haweitz and Bori Pri Hagofen and so on, this was ordained by whom? By the rabbanim. It's not the deraisahu, it's ordained by the rabbanim, so that therefore they can excuse you from doing it if the circumstances warrant it. But Rabbi Yehuda, he says that they do both before and for after. And it says the Gemara mefarshla. Gemara is going to explain. All right. Now the Gemara continues. Omer Ravina. Ravina said Zosomeris. Now, if that's the case, if I understand, he says the Mishnah literally, then here who can divur dome? Then we would say that mentally thinking over the words has the same value as saying them actually, right? The salkodate lav kedivur dome, because if it occurs to you that it is not, doesn't have the same value as saying it aloud, it's uttering the words actually, then loma maharher, then why should he just think mentally? Elamai hiru kedivur dome, siosi bisposo. But if you argue that, the two are the same, that hearer is the same as Dibur, then in that case, Yochi Biswasa, then let him, why should he simply think it mentally? Mm-hmm. Let the Mishnah state specifically that, he can recite the Brocha the way we normally do. He can recite Krishna and so on. Yeah. And he says, Kida Ashkechon B'Sinai, as we found that this was the case at Mount Sinai. What happened at Mount Sinai? Okay, so Rashi explains, Shehit Prishon Yishon. Moshe Rabbeinu said to the people of Israel, he said to them, if you remember, that for 3 days you have to be separated from your wife, right? Al tikshu elisho, do not approach your wife, okay? And the al prisha zu somach ezra. And Rashi says, it was this which served as the precedent for Ezra to insist that men also then should be separated from their wives before they can continue to study Torah. The Sakein Tbilo, in that, he ordained that they have to immerse themselves in the mikveh, Levali Kriyin, for people who have the seminal mission, Koidem Sheyasku Batera, before they should begin to study Torah. Dichsiv, and he bases it, that is, Ezra based it upon the interpretation of the Torah where it's written, Behodatom Levanecho. First of all, it says, you shall teach the words of the Torah to your children. And then right next to it says, on the day when you stood before the Lord your God on Mount Horeb, because Horeb is the same as Sinai. And so therefore, just as at Mount Sinai, men had to be separated from women, so likewise he says, that as Ezra said, okay, that in order to study Torah, which after all was given at Mount Sinai, right? So we should also have the same separation in order to preserve the holiness. All right. So this is what we have decided so far, that maybe hirhur kedibur domi, right? That thinking mentally may be perhaps equated with
saying it out loud.
Right. Now, Rav Chista, on the other hand, he disagrees. He says, Rav Chista, Omar, hear her love, kedibur domi. He says, no, sorry, he says. Just thinking aloud, just thinking the words, the blessings, the Krishna, and so on, is not the same as actually saying them. The Zalkodate hear her kedibur domi, because if you would say that hear her, then thinking it is the same as saying it, then Yotzi Bisposov, then why shouldn't he say the words? Elamai here who love Kiddimundamim.